Hi, I'm Steve.
And I'm Dan, and we're going to talk about The Walking Dead, Season 5, Episode 5, titled Self-Help.
Subtitled The Abraham and Eugene Show. So we've got another departure episode, another focus episode, this time on the group that took Glenn and Maggie away from Rick and the gang, and any concern about Maggie's sister Beth.
Back on the road.
We get some really interesting banter between the characters, we learn a lot, and there's several flashbacks throughout the episode which are intended to tell us a lot about Abraham and who he really is under the surface.
Pretty much the whole of the Abraham backstory that we need to understand his motivations in the TV show.
There was a bit of a problem with this, though, wasn't there? I mean, like, I'm a comic book reader, so I'm familiar already with Abraham's background, and I didn't have a lot of problems with the way it was presented, but perhaps for people who aren't readers, it can be a bit more problematic.
Yeah, well, I'm not a reader, and so the only thing I know about Abraham is that he's this tough sergeant guy who's another survivor out on the road. He's led a few groups. His heart's in the right place. He's a military guy. He seems to be committed to the mission of getting Eugene to Washington, D.C., but that's kind of all we know. We don't know too much about his motivations. We know that he likes a fight. He's spoken about it before. He's pretty handy, but we don't know anything else apart from that.
Exactly. And so the flashbacks are supposed to serve as a method of teaching us a bit more about where he comes from.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem becomes the flashbacks are almost done in shorthand. So you've got the scene where he's just destroying a guy with a tin can. He's smashing his face over and over and over again, stands up, looks down at the gurgling mess of a man, crushes his throat with his foot.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look up and there's like another three or four bodies along this aisle and what appears to be a grocery store. And they're all bloody messes, just like the same guy, just like the guy he killed.
I actually paused it at that point because I was interested to know what that can was that he was smashing the guy in the face with.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look closer, you can just make it out. And do you know what that can was?
I did not see a label.
It was a can of whoop-ass.
It was a can of whoop-ass. And then he turns around to what we find out, kind of, are his wife and two kids.
Well, at that point, he's just standing in a supermarket aisle, and he just looks like he was shopping, and someone had bumped into them, and he'd smashed them to pieces, and then he's like, okay, what am I supposed to get?
This is true. There's absolutely no context.
Now, we knew that they were real people that he was smashing, not zombies.
The gurgling sound was definitely unzombie-like.
Yeah, and the guy's hand, he looked kind of healthy still.
Except for the whole twitchiness and dying thing.
Yeah. Actually, nice balance to the show, because we kind of start with an image like that and we end with a similar one, don't we?
Oh, actually quite similar. He gets up and he's shaking and he's obviously in something of a bloodlust, and he looks at his hand and he seems really disturbed by it, and then he turns and he starts shouting for Ellen. Now, I'm going to combine a bunch of the flashbacks here together, except for the very last one, which I think we should leave till the end. But he basically gets up, walks forward towards the front of the store, hiding behind the counter at the cash register. There's a woman who has two kids with her. One who is the younger spitting image of Abraham with the red hair and everything. And he calls him AJ, which I would be willing to bet money on being short for Abraham Jr. He's very familiar with the two kids and with the mother. We're assuming at this point probably his wife and kids.
Although they don't look too pleased to see him for some reason.
And in the context of what we learned from the show, all he says to her is he won't be able to touch you again.
Right.
So there's an indication that the guy tried to touch her. Now, that's rather tame, to be perfectly honest, for him to take the actions he's just taken. And her reaction indicates he's overreacted. She appears frightened of him. She wants him to stay back. And in fact, in a later flashback, when he wakes up, he finds they're gone. And they've left a note. Don't try to follow us.
Not being a comic reader, the whole sense I got from that was that they don't like what their dad's become.
Yeah, there's definitely a sense that he's got a monster inside of him that could be unleashed at any point. He went full beast mode on those guys. Now, in the context of the comic books, and I'm going to have a bit of a spoiler here, so if you don't want to hear anything about the comics, pause or skip about a minute here. In the context of the comics, the people that he's with were his neighbors, people that were friends, people that they knew quite well and had socialized with. And when the proverbial crap hit the fan, they went with them as a group. Now, he was on a run to get food for the group. Those men raped his wife and children.
Ah, right. Yeah, you kind of guess something like that happened.
But they don't spell it out. And if it's just a matter of touching, yeah, you beat the crap out of them and you leave, but you don't crush their skulls. So they don't clarify that enough for the people that haven't read the comics. And so I know that there's been some confusion amongst a few people who haven't read the comics as to why he went so crazy. And why did she want to run away? There's a lot of subtext that isn't being spelled out. I think that they were using shorthand a little bit too much in those flashbacks.
So all that seems to matter for watchers of the show is that he had some kind of tragic parting with his family.
Exactly. And we find out, of course, that goes to no good end later in his last flashback. He comes outside. He's looking for his family. He finds them.
They didn't make it too far.
No, they're just around the corner. And they've been eaten so badly they haven't even turned. So there's his wife's body, his two children. You don't see it too graphically. I think that was a tasteful choice. But he falls to his knees, puts his gun into his mouth. He's going to end it. Yes. Smash cut back to the beginning.
We start off the show in the bus, and everyone's having a jolly time. Abraham's driving along, and Rosita's playing with his hair. hair seems to be quite thematic today.
Yeah, they're talking about, she's talking about how she's going to give him a trim because his hair's getting a bit long. And then Tara makes a suggestion that maybe Eugene wouldn't mind getting a bit of a trim as well.
She says party's getting a little long in the back there.
She does. He brings up the fact that the head of the Human Genome Project, T. Brooks Ellis, mm-hmm. told him that it made him look like an interesting fellow. So, or a fun guy. It makes him look like a fun guy. So he decides to, you know, he decides to keep it because if T. Brooks Ellis likes something, then obviously he is a trend setter, that fella.
I just wanted to mention, yep. When Rosita touches the back of Abraham's hair, she's like, you know, you're kind of letting yourself go a little bit. And he's like, well, I'm preparing myself for retirement. Maybe be a sheep herder. Now, Abraham is a biblical figure who was a shepherd.
I wonder if there's a connection.
Maybe there's a connection, Steve.
Well, we're going back now to his son dying. Abraham, of course, was told by God to sacrifice his firstborn son to show his faith. And he gets to the point of actually raising the knife. He's going to do it before the angel of God comes down and says, no, just kidding. We're just testing your faith. And then he sacrifices a sheep, right, in his stead.
Yeah, there's a ram with his horns caught in a bush or something.
That's right. They just happen to appear.
Yeah, so he doesn't have to sacrifice. But he does become known for another sacrifice in the Bible, actually. Done a bit of research here, Steve.
Okay.
And the most significant sacrifice of Abraham's life, as far as I'm concerned, is that he was the first person to introduce the covenant of circumcision.
Oh, that bastard.
Yeah, so he was the first person that God asked to remove that part of his anatomy.
I'm sorry.
And he self-circumcised at the age of 99.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I actually had a friend. We could do a whole sub-show on circumcision here, I suppose.
We could.
I have a friend that decided to get circumcised as an adult. He said it was the worst choice he ever made.
Jeez, I imagine. Why did your friend decide to do that?
It was for health reasons, actually. It wasn't a religious choice. It wasn't aesthetic.
He considered himself too healthy. He wanted to change that.
I believe that's what it was. No, I not to get into too many details, and certainly not to mention my friend's name, but I do believe that he had some issues with the foreskin and, you know, attachments and things like that. And he wasn't feeling too attached to
and
it.
And the attachments?
He was feeling very attached to him.
He was very attached to it?
Yes, he was.
Or his foreskin had attachments.
Exactly. It got in the way of stuff. So, yeah, he had it removed, but it was very painful and very difficult. I can imagine a 99-year-old with no OxyContin to help with the pain. That would have been pretty tough.
Ouch.
They did have wine. They had lots of wine.
Lots of wine. Lots of sheep.
He wouldn't have been going anywhere near the sheep for some time after that.
All right. So Abraham's in the bus. They start quizzing Eugene all about his hair.
But then Maggie asks him, so how long is it going to take to fix this thing once we get to DC? Get you down on that terminal. And Eugene starts making these kind of almost military type comments, talking about target sites, talking about density of walkers.
Classified stuff.
Oh, it's all classified.
At the time, it just sounds like the kind of like pseudo-scientific, pseudo-militaristic nonsense that Eugene's been coming out with the whole time. But it has particular resonance here. Because as we find out later in last night's episode, Eugene's kind of been stringing along, manipulating the group. But as he's sitting there and he's saying things like classified airstrike, the camera cuts to Abraham, who's kind of nodding sagely. Like, this guy's talking my language, you know, he understands the logic of operations. He respects the fact that Eugene still has respect for the idea of it being classified. Although this comes across as Eugene's kind of weird, nerdy, scientific persona, it could just be part of an elaborate act all set up to appeal to Abraham, who is his chief protector.
Well, and it's, as we do find out, yes, this is definitely aimed at Abraham.
And one of the biggest reasons why I hope that Eugene is still alive next week,
yes,
or whenever he comes back, is I want to find out how much his character changes now that he's put all his cards on the table.
Will he come out of his monotone and add a second tone to his voice? We don't know.
He could be completely different.
He could be. I suspect that the way that he's being played, to be perfectly honest, is like borderline autistic spectrum disorder, possibly Asperger's, in the sense that he has no affect in his voice. He simply delivers lines in a real monotone. Yeah, I'm going to be doing this, and this is what we're going to be doing. And he does things that should elicit emotion. Later in the episode, we see him voyeuristically watching Abraham and Rosita having sex. And he just stands there and stares, and they look at him, and Abraham laughs and says that he's harmless. And he still continues to stare. There is no emotional response from him. As he tells Tara afterwards, he considers it a victimless crime. It's a win-win.
Yeah.
He gets what he wants, they're getting what they want. And it's just kind of awkward.
It was awkward. Actually, now we're talking about that line. You know, the character of Rosita.
Yes.
We've had this discussion a few times. We're not really sure what her purpose is, other than being Abraham's girlfriend and the person who kind of calms him down a little bit. But when I was hearing Eugene's line, he said, I enjoy the female form and I consider this a victimless crime that provides both comfort and distraction.
Mm-hmm.
That almost, to me, sounds like a justification for having Rosita in the TV show. Because They are not too shy about showing her with her cleavage all the time.
This is true, or her midriff beard, yeah.
Yeah, she's a beautiful woman, and I'm wondering whether that was kind of like a wry acknowledgement of Rosita's role in the show on behalf of the scriptwriters.
Well, and not to, again, give anything away, she is a character in the comic books. She's not one of the creations a la Daryl. She does have a role to play in the comic books, and I don't see anything she's done here that is against that role. There are always going to be sidekicks. There are always going to be people kind of on the periphery. I think at the moment she's one of the peripheral people. She could very well do more later. They had an opportunity here to do backstory on her. They could have shown her in flashbacks meeting Abraham or something like that because they were showing his flashbacks, but they chose not to. So she's almost a non-entity.
That is how she's been written. Her only other role, apart from being Abraham's sexual partner and companion, seems to be in her ability to moderate him, to soften him a little bit, like she's seen as his softer side. But Abraham's developing this relationship with Glenn that seems to be developing along the same lines. Like, Glenn's becoming a bit of a confidant for Abraham. Later on in the show, when everyone's questioning Abraham's authority, Glenn takes him to one side, and Abraham kind of opens up a little bit. This is right after the bus has crashed, and he's insisting that they move on. He says, Abraham says, look, I took a bit of a whack in the sacks back then. I'm feeling depressed about the ride, you know. I'd really like it if you guys supported me. Like, he kind of opens up a little bit to Glenn. So it seems that Glenn is playing that moderating, comforting role in a more effective and efficient way than Rosita would, because we don't need two characters to do the same thing anymore.
And we like Glenn more than we like Rosita.
We do. We tend to. Most of us do, anyway.
I don't see them having sex anytime soon, though. I don't think Glenn swings that way, nor does Abraham, I don't believe, so...
To my knowledge, there's only been about three, maybe four sex scenes in the show. The best one, I thought, wasn't the first time Glenn and Maggie got together?
Yeah, there's the scene where they go to the store in town. Before that, we had Shane and Laurie. That was the first sex scene in the show.
Was it Shane and Laurie? Yeah, I remembered Rick and Laurie.
But... Yeah, there was Shane and Laurie first, and then when Rick comes back, there's Rick and Laurie, although we don't see much because Carl's kind of in the tent with them. There's a hint that Andrea and her sister are perhaps having sex with Dale.
I'm glad you put Dale in there at the end.
With Dale. That's right. And then Andrea does have sex with the governor, and she also grabs...
That's horrible. Did they show that?
They show her in bed with him, and she also, earlier than that, grabs Shane's penis at one point.
I remember that.
To his pants, so there's kind of a sexual thing there. Not that I remember all the sexual moments, but I remember all the sexual moments. So there's not that many. There's no nudity in the show, although we did get to see Abraham's butt.
I was going to say, that's one thing, you know, you got to credit them here. In this scene, it's Abraham's body who seems to be objectified more so than Rosita's.
And they were actually tweeting last night about Dolphin Smooth, about how smooth his back and buttocks were. Yeah, you kind of expected this big, heavy red shag all down his back, but no.
So they're in a bookstore, and the reason they're in a bookstore is because something went wrong with that church bus.
There was an explosion in the engine. Abraham couldn't see where he was going. He was too busy with focusing on Rosita's fingers in his hair. He hits another vehicle, and the bus flips onto its side. And it's a wreck. It's done. In fact, it's on fire. They get out. They start taking out a bunch of walkers, because the walkers are quite curious about all the sound. Tara has an interesting moment with Eugene here inside the bus.
Right, Eugene's cowering in the back.
And he's not going to come out on his own.
No.
And on top of that, another walker shoves his head through a window. Really interesting moment there, too. You see the walker actually impale himself on some glass at the bottom of the window, and his guts are spewing out all around him. Very well done.
Yeah, he looked a little bit like the alt country singer Bonnie Prince Billy, with his bald head and his big beard.
Expect him to pull out a guitar at any moment.
He was probably my favorite zombie today.
He was pretty awesome. I have to say that some of the zombies that get eroded by Eugene's fire hose spray later were pretty cool too.
And there was one, while we're talking about favorite zombies, there was one that Abraham kills with the butt of his gun. He just kind of knocks him on the head, and the zombie goes down on his knees, and he's not quite finished. He just canes him again.
You see his head disintegrating in half. Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah, it was very well
done. Yeah, that was beautiful.
It was a moment of glory, yes. A moment of gory, perhaps.
To me, far more erotic than any of the bookstore scenes.
Yeah, but Abraham does have a fine ass, I have to say.
He's smooth.
Smooth as a dolphin's butt.
So Tara's giving Eugene a bit of a pep talk.
And she hands him a knife. And he stands there looking like a complete dork, shaking, holding the knife out front of him, watching everybody else do the job that they have to do. He's kind of like Super Tyrese in this moment.
Yeah, kind of.
He's not exactly anti-violence, as we see in a little while, but he is too afraid to step forward. And then finally he does. And this is kind of a nice scene. He actually steps up for another group member, which is the first time we've seen Eugene do this. Tara is taking out one walker. A second walker attacks her from behind. You know, he's seen a lot of walkers go down. He's seen a lot of different methods for taking walkers down. What's the one thing that ties all those walker deaths together?
Something about the head.
You hit him in the head. That's right. Where does he stab this walker?
In the shoulder.
In the shoulder. I mean, there's... Yeah, okay, he walks out. The walker's not even looking at him. There's no threat. he can't even hit the head. It's no. pretty sad.
But he's saving Tara, right?
That's right.
Because that this walker looks like it could be getting her in the back at any point. So he stabs in the shoulder. But then I've got a bit of a gripe with some of the deaths in this show in okay. general. Tara turns around and finishes the job. But from my angle, it looked like she stabbed thing in the neck, not in the head. And then 2 seconds later, the camera pans and then Abraham's finishing off the last zombie. He lunges in and definitely stabs the zombie in the neck.
And you see another one with Rosita. And Rosita stabs it up through the jaw.
Yeah.
And it doesn't go anywhere except for perhaps a sinus.
Yeah, the jaw one, you know, I don't know, maybe that they just didn't make it look too good, but he definitely stabs it in the neck. Now, what do we know about zombies? Is just cutting off the supply of whatever it is to the brain enough, or do they have to kill the brain? Because these things drop.
Well, think back to the governor. The governor had his aquarium full of moving zombie heads.
Exactly. Yeah. So why do these guys just drop when they get a knife in the neck?
Probably because they were told to by the director. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It doesn't follow through. And there have been a lot of deaths like that over the course of the 5 years, where they obviously don't quite hit them in the right spot, but maybe the shot was right otherwise, so they go with it. And a lot of the stuff is green screened, a lot of the stuff is after effects and things like that, so it could be post-production issues as well. Quibbles. So we're they have the bus crash, they go to the bookstore, we've kind of gotten there. The bookstore has this really interesting montage sequence, which kind of reminded me a little bit of the kinds of montages you see in Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead, except much slower. It's not the high-speed montages you get there with the Edgar Wright movies. You do see them very coolly, very efficiently, and with very little conversation, simply going about their tasks. You can see that this is a group of people that are used to living on the road, that are used to finding what they need resource-wise. We see a really cool moment there where Eugene takes a battery and a strip of paper and uses it to light a fire.
I didn't even know that was a thing.
No, neither did I. I'm learning things from Eugene. That's one of the reasons why I really hope his character's not dead, because he teaches me stuff every week.
How to break your way out of shipping containers with
a
cartridge.
Lie yourself. Oh, yeah, and how to lie to people for months and get people killed.
Some high-quality lying, too.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he's got all the details. The guy knows what he's doing.
My favorite line from Eugene all night, I am smarter than you.
Yeah, it didn't end out too well for him, did it?
You don't look a rabid dog in the eye and growl at it.
No.
That's not a good idea.
And then start making jokes about your hair right after you've told everyone that you've completely betrayed them and killed half of their friends. So the scene in the bookstore, you're right, I actually really liked it. When you watched it, it was all dark and moody. There were kind of noir elements to it, I felt.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like it was an attempt to get across the idea that today's episode has a kind of dark theme, because of course we're talking about Abraham's backstory, which is kind of dark and gloomy. So it seemed to me that the bookstore scenes were designed to mirror that. We're in there for a long time. I think it's close to 10 minutes of darkness.
Mm-hmm.
We get that montage scene of them getting things ready. And you're right, it was really effective. I particularly like the detail of fishing the water out of the toilet system.
And then using the coat hangers over the fire to boil the water.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the best things about good literature is that you get a lot of those little details interspersed, you know? And sometimes with TV shows, you can feel like people are just standing around getting their dialogue out when they could be doing something that kind of reveals a bit more of the minutiae of the experience.
Well, this was a good use of silence, wasn't it? It was a narrative moment.
It was a great use of silence, and it's kind of poetic as well, because you have those zombies outside just kind of ambling by, and there's the wand just slowly gnawing at the glass and then moving on. And when the scene comes to a close, the screen is almost completely black, this small greyish bluish panel where the window is, and you just see a zombie just kind of ambling across. And again, Bear McCreary's score, really effective here, kind of these somber tones that have been interspersed with the sounds of Abraham humming some song. I found the whole montage scene and indeed the whole period in the bookstore kind of quite effective, even though it's one of the slowest scenes that we've had so far. It was sort of reminiscent of what they did outside the church.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to me, it's kind of a good sign. Like, it's slow. It shows a crew that are happy to kind of take their time. They're confident in their ability to sustain the story without having to constantly take us from set piece to set piece. And they've got faith in the cinematography to carry it all through. And I thought that it was fairly effective.
I thought so too. I think there was a bit of a missed opportunity, though, in the fact that they're in a bookstore and they're using pages from books to light their fires, and they're burning books. Of course, burning books, it's heavily symbolic. They could have utilized that. I think it would have been kind of neat to see them throwing a couple of, like, chicken soup for the soul books or something into the fire.
Right.
Kind of showing the useless pop psychology crap that's out there in the world today.
Yeah.
That people spend millions, in fact, billions worldwide on. And how useful is that in the zombie apocalypse? I mean, they'd be putting aside, you know, mechanics books and physics books and things like that. But they could, you know, it would have been interesting to see what they were burning. Now, he does choose to take a book out, doesn't he?
Yeah, he takes H.G. Wells' The Shape of Things to Come. I haven't read the book. Have you read it, Steve?
No, I've read a lot of Wells, but not that book.
No, I took a look into it. Apparently, it is a post-apocalyptic story. It's about how the world's politics just become so completely corrupted and broken that the only way to save the world is to generate a world state. And it's composed of various polymaths and geniuses. So the whole IQ level of civilization rises to the point where several, I think it's like 100 years down the line, the government no longer becomes necessary because the whole world is populated by polymaths, you know, people with an array of knowledge, which is very different from the educational impetus today, which is to kind of specialize in certain things.
Mm-hmm.
But what it sort of suggested to me was something about Eugene's character. I mean, he would be much happier in a world where knowledge was kind of the governing principle.
Absolutely. Of course, we do have to remember that H.G. Wells had no access to all the different studies that show that serial killers tend to have above average IQs. I don't think it would be a perfect world if it was run by polymaths, frankly. But yeah, Eugene would love it. You know, he says, I'm smarter than average. And he says, I'm smarter than you. Poke, poke, poke. Here's a stick, Abraham. But we'll talk about that in a little bit.
We'll talk about that in a bit.
The next day, they spend the night, and Rosita goes quietly to Abraham. And this is an interesting moment, because she's publicly she's always very supportive of Abraham. But she goes to him quietly when they're alone and says, hey, maybe we should stay here for another day. And she suggests that maybe one of the reasons why they keep on having bumps along the road is because they're never quite prepared when they leave.
Right.
Which resonates, as you were pointing out to me earlier in a separate conversation, with something from Abraham, right?
Yeah, it does. In an earlier episode in the last season, I can't remember what number it was, but the episode is called Us, and this is right about when Glenn has met up with Abraham, and Glenn is trying to get back and rescue Maggie, and I think Tara says that she'll go with him.
That was episode 415, just to let you know.
But they come across a very similar scenario. They're heading in the right direction to rescue Maggie and to meet up with the rest of the group, and they see a tunnel, and Abraham's like, well, there ain't no way we're going through that tunnel. We're going to have to back up and go around. And Glenn's like, no, this is the quickest way to get through. This is the route I have to take. And they part ways at that point. Abraham decides he doesn't want to risk it. This seems to be in contrast with what Abraham's suggesting in the bookstore, because he's like, no, we can't wait around for another minute.
Yeah, and he later on in the episode, when they're, you know, facing, we'll talk about that later, but when they're facing a huge horde of zombies, he actually says the line, we don't go back, we can't go back.
Yeah.
Which actually echoes Glenn's line from No Sanctuary, first episode of this season, where he says, you know, that's who we are. We have to be. It's a sort of kind of declarative moment where he's trying to define himself and define his group and define his place. And that's Abraham's new definition for himself. He's moved on, right? He's no longer able to go back. He's a motive force.
Right, yeah. So it seems that in a world that is now very uncertain, you find many characters reaching out for a particular guiding principle with which to make their decisions, you know.
And hence something, the religious overtones that have been hitting us pretty hard this season.
Pretty much, yeah. It seems that everyone has their own kind of spiritual muse, whether it's just a belief in no surrender, no retreat, which is kind of like, and for Abraham, it seems to be like a mutation of the military ethos. But yeah, everyone seems to be reaching out for a particular principle with which to guide their actions.
No, it's true. There seems to be, you know, obviously we've got the figure of Father Gabriel back at the church, who has a strong ethos and yet is a sinner under the surface. Mm-hmm. Eugene even brings him up at one point when he's obviously contemplating his own sins. They all seem to have this kind of focus on right and wrong, but at the same time, there's a recognition that it's not always just about right and wrong. It's about strong and weak. For Abraham, it's strength. For Eugene, it's acceptance and survival. For Glenn, it's peace, you know, trying to keep peace amongst everybody.
For Bob, it was acceptance, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because like with Bob, he lost the previous two groups he's been with and was sure he was going to lose this group, and then he turns out to be the one to die. And so but at the end, he is accepted, and he's peaceful. He's at peace when he dies. Here, you've got Eugene kind of contemplating what Gabriel did, because they all know now that he kept the parishioners closed out of the church and basically led to all of their deaths, men, women, children. And he's obviously fighting his own internal demons.
He definitely is, yeah. I think at one point, Tara asks him what he's thinking about in the bus, and he says last night and what the pastor did.
Yep, and this is interesting, because Tara is another one of those problematic characters like Rosita, who doesn't seem to have a huge role in the show. I think they're trying to find roles for her.
Yeah.
And here you've got a situation where maybe she's being a bit of a confessor.
Yeah, she's a confidant.
Mm-hmm. And she has the awkward fist bump.
Yeah.
that's her thing. She's also at present the only openly gay character in the show, which is an important part of the diversity that they're obviously trying to go for. This is a brief spoiler that doesn't give any actual information away, but there are other gay characters in the comic books.
Very much so.
Yeah, so that's part of that world already. And I think that in television, they're always a bit more hesitant to go down that route than in literature.
Yeah, up until the character of Omar in The Wire, I think, was probably a major breakthrough for homosexual characters that were also seen as strong and active.
Yeah, that's true. And we have another character in Scandal that's currently airing,
right,
who's basically the... I can't remember the position, but he's like a very close aide to the president. And he's an openly gay man as well, which is a fairly new thing in television. Okay, so you've got her being the confessor to Eugene's confessee, and she seems to be able to bring things out of him without even really trying, which is interesting. He obviously is ready to confess.
It seems to me, yeah. She's a good test case.
And she promises not to tell his secrets either. And interestingly enough, later, when he has the big reveal, she still doesn't give up his secret, which is that he caused the crash of the bus.
Yeah, well, at that point, it doesn't seem worth making Abraham any angrier than he's gonna be.
No, because, you know, he could kill Eugene even harder, I suppose.
What do you think about Tara's decision? I don't know. I thought it was almost a little bit self-serving. I mean, she catches him there. She wants to say sorry. She's obviously got a bit emotionally invested in this character. She wants to help him become tougher and, you know, help stand up for himself and ergo the rest of the group. Now, when he tells her this thing, she's a little bit horrified, but she's very quick to sort of keep it between them. It doesn't seem to be a particularly good judgment call because this person's basically admitting that he's a liability. But she seems to find it almost flattering that he confides it to her and that she can then kind of mother him and they can have something that's just between them, like it gives her a little bit of value. I wasn't really sure about her motivations in that scene.
Well, she is an outsider herself, and she still feels like she's an outsider. We saw her 2 weeks ago when she tells Maggie that she was there when the governor attacked, that she was there, part of the group that killed Herschel, right? So she, even though she's been accepted and forgiven, and there was actually a really important scene in that Maggie gave her a hug and forgave her. So maybe she herself feels that she's been forgiven for some past mistakes. Maybe she's in no position to judge. Maybe she needs to forgive as well.
She needs to pay it forward.
So I think that's part of what's going on. But there's also the sense of needing an ally within the group. Glenn was her ally, but, well, Glenn's with Maggie now. So Glenn and Tara are no longer talking all that much even. It's not that Glenn doesn't like her or, you know, what have you, but they don't have the relationship they had at the end of last season.
All right, so the next morning, we're in the bookstore, and Rosita and Abraham have this discussion. A few people put their oar in, but Rosita stands up for Abraham. She realizes that he's not for turning.
Well, the interesting thing is she's being a good soldier because she's just said to Abraham, let's stay, let's not go.
Yeah.
He's like, I don't think we should, we need to move on. They show up, they immediately shut up, and then Rosita says, we need to move on. It's not Abraham's idea at all at this point. She presents it as her own. And he says, well, you know, listen to the woman, gotta listen to what she says.
But they don't have a vehicle.
Ah, but you see, Abraham has spied something across the street.
A fire truck.
Everybody wants to be a fireman. And he points out the benefit that the fire truck brings with it, a 500-gallon water tank. So they, because at one point Tara says, well, the nearest river is 5 miles to the east or to the west, I guess. So we have to go there before we go anywhere. And there's Abraham saying, nope, there's a fire truck. But he doesn't know if the tank's full of water. And if it is, it's been sitting there for 2 years. Is it really water you want to be drinking? You know, they've been boiling all their water anyhow, right? So they go across to the truck and, miracle of miracles, the thing starts up on the first try.
It does. Then it quickly dies. And actually, we were being a bit harsh on Rosita earlier, saying that she didn't have much of a purpose, but she solves this, doesn't she?
She does. Yeah. He goes to start clearing off this air intake on the side of the vehicle, and she looks at him like he's an idiot.
Yeah.
And says, you know, the engine intake's on the roof.
How would you know that?
She's a mechanic. Yeah, so we've kind of established that she grew up with mechanics, or her father was a mechanic and she was a mechanic in his shop.
Mm-hmm.
That she knows mechanical stuff. She helped fix the bus. She helped fix the vehicle when they were driving earlier with Eugene when they met Glenn. And that could give her some more purpose for sure. If she's our vehicle person, bang. That gives her a very important job. So he's going to clear that off. But in starting the vehicle, they rolled it forward about 15, 20 feet.
Yeah, revealing a door. It seems like the fire engine had been used by whoever was previously driving it around to seal up the fire hall with a bunch of people who had the virus at the time, but they're very much zombies now.
Exactly. And so a wheel comes rolling out. They kind of look at the wheel. What's that?
That was nice.
It was well done. Because, you know, the horror is always greater when you don't see the creature initially. And we see the creatures all the time in this show. So It's nice to have a moment like that creates a moment, just a kind of a bit of tension, a bit of suspense. And out come the hordes.
Quite a lot of them.
There are. In fact, they're getting to a point, they're coming from both sides of the engine, and they're getting overwhelmed.
Things actually look pretty grim at that point. The guys jump forward and start smacking a few of them. Abraham has this, what I consider to be a bad habit, of running into a fight and pushing them around a bit before he starts to smack them. But he's pushing a few of these zombies in the chest, and he's surrounded by about five or six. And it looked to me like he could be in some trouble.
There was one coming right onto his shoulder, yeah. Teeth first.
But then...
Eugene.
Yeah, Eugene's on the roof, and he's got the hose.
Eugene to the rescue.
Exercising a bit of crowd control. He starts spraying everyone down, and that turns out to be a pretty effective way of disposing of these rather soft zombies.
The cottage cheese texture of their bodies simply disintegrates under the force of the hose.
Yeah.
I love the scene for visuals. I thought it was very well done. You actually could see them eroding as the water was striking them. There was a bit of a problem I had with it.
Go on.
Where's the power for the hose coming from? Where's the pressure coming from?
Was the engine started at that point?
No. It wasn't. Sometimes you just have to swallow it and say it was a pretty cool scene.
I don't know. I mean, do they have like residual kind of backup pumps that will just run?
I'm sure they do, but have you ever left a car unstarted over the winter?
No.
Okay, because I used to have a 48 Dodge, and I didn't want to run it in the wintertime because, you know, no seatbelts, no safety devices, right? So I'd let it sit for 6 months, and inevitably, I would have to charge up the battery. Now, they're going to be using heavy-duty batteries in a fire truck, but 2 years of sitting, I just don't. Most batteries are not going to hold a charge.
No. He did get it started up for about 10 seconds previously, but I'm presuming that wouldn't be enough to get things going.
Yeah, there might be enough residual charge for one start, and if you get it going, good for you. Maybe it can then, you know, build up some charge.
Yeah.
But it only runs for, like you say, about 10 seconds.
I did a little bit of research on fire trucks, actually. Think
they're usually red.
They're usually red.
Some have a ladder.
They're usually red. Yes. And I was thinking how practical one of those would be as a post-apocalyptic vehicle. Not very, it turns out. Mm-hmm. They can hold enough gas for 8 hours of continuous use idling, but they get pretty lousy mileage, and you'd probably get less than 4 hours out of a full tank of one on a highway.
Oh, well, yeah, that's a big issue.
And then you've got to find a lot of diesel.
Yes. What you need is a fire truck towing a diesel truck behind it.
Yeah, or just fill up its water tank with diesel. What could go wrong?
Nothing. So we kind of skipped over the sabotage. We briefly talked about it, but then we didn't really... We do have to talk about that briefly, because Eugene has this interesting moment with the confessional that we were talking about 10 minutes ago, where he admits to taking light bulbs from the church that he found in storage, crushing them, and putting them into the gas line of the bus, with the intent that it would spring a leak and stop within a few miles of the church, and they'd get to go back. He did express, when Abraham said it was time to leave... Yeah. Two episodes ago, that he didn't want to go, although he quickly caved when Abraham said they were gone. So he tries to undermine Abraham's authority in a kind of a passive-aggressive sabotage. He doesn't expect it to explode.
Yeah, it's just going
to
grind to a halt. It was just bad timing, really, wasn't it? The engine just seemed to blow. If they were just on the straight, it would have been fine, but they were negotiating a few crashed vehicles at the time, and the bus sort of launched off of one of them.
And this is, I mean, we did talk about the way the terror reacts, the horror, but we didn't talk about the actual crushed glass, so I just wanted to bring that up, that was what he'd done. So now they get into the situation. He does say... Going back, sorry again briefly, he does say that the reason he does it is because he's afraid of getting to Washington. He's afraid that maybe he won't be able to solve the problem.
Well, his lie is unraveling, isn't it?
It is. The closer he gets, the more worried he gets. Now, I personally feel like if you take it this far, you get them to Washington, you make them take you to some building that you say is what you say it is, because they're not going to know different. And you go in there and say, oh, crap. The building's been destroyed, or, oh, they've taken all their research, can't do it. Well, you never, ever have to give up the lie.
Yeah, there was definitely no need to do it now. That was something I was thinking as well. I could think of multiple scenarios, even if you got to D.C. and what's the institute that he's trying to get to?
I guess it's probably the National Institute of Science.
So whatever that is, you know, even if he gets there and it's intact... The worst case scenario is that he admits he's lying at that point, and by then they're in civilization. Abraham's not killing anyone. He can just slink off.
But in a crazy twist, as the door opens, it's T. Brooks Ellis. Hey, I heard you really like Eugene's hair. What?
That's really the scenario he was trying to avoid. He'd have to take responsibility for his own mullet.
That's right.
So the mullet, so far you've just been figuring that it's a form of disguise. He's a smart guy, dress up like a hillbilly with a mullet, then no one's going to suspect that you're smart and valuable.
It's a Kentucky waterfall.
Yeah, but can we just presume now that he just likes it?
I think that he just has absolutely no fashion sense whatsoever. He's secretly a Canadian from the 1980s. So now we're back. We're back to the fire truck.
Fire truck. Yeah.
So
all right.
So before Eugene gets on the top and does the hose thing, and before Abraham gets surrounded, there is that awesome zombie you mentioned earlier that gets like the whack-a-mole treatment. Glenn's dealing with it. They're all dealing with their zombies. But like when Eugene takes over, another interesting side effect is that like the bodies are being sprayed aside, but so is a whole bunch of detritus that was on the ground. And it reveals a sign. Abraham gets up on top of the fire truck to clear out the air intake. And he looks down and starts laughing. And everybody's like, what the hell's wrong with you, Abraham? Have you lost it? And on the ground, there's a big sign painted in red says, sick inside, let them die. So if they'd seen that, they would have known, you know, but of course, they weren't being very observant, perhaps a little bit complacent.
Yeah, Abraham's having a great time at that point. He thinks it's hilarious.
Yeah, well, I think he's, you know, you read accounts of people surviving battles and situations where they're facing death. And there are a few different reactions that people have. Some people go into shock. Some people go into, you know, a real introspective kind of moment. But there are other people who react like Abraham. They're like, holy crap, I'm still alive. Wow, this is awesome. And they start laughing. And it becomes almost this kind of a false jubilation. Or not even false, it's a jubilation. It's a celebration of still being alive. And I think that's who Abraham is.
Yeah, and just the absurdity of the situation. I'm slinging guts out from the air intake of a fire truck so that I can drive it to DC to save America.
I would love to see the outtakes from that scene, see if Glenn gets a big faceful. It looked like he was in the line of fire, actually.
Yeah, so right after Eugene destroys all the zombies with his big hose...
There's nothing euphemistic about that whatsoever. Nothing. No, no.
And then Abraham's strutting around and he thinks it's hilarious. And he says his line. He says, I've been to 8 country fairs and 1 goat rodeo, but I've never seen anything like that. Would you expect to see something like that at a country fair?
No, but you might expect to see it in the 1960s civil rights movement.
Oh, Stonewall style?
Yeah, exactly. It was that kind of civil disobedience water hosing moment that was going on.
Well, interesting. They've just okayed water hoses for crowd control in London, I believe.
Oh, God.
At least they were discussing
it
recently. Part of the counter-terrorism measures.
Yeah, well, you know, Croydon's full of terrorists.
Yeah,
of course,
terrorists and zombies.
Yeah, and watch out for those groups down in Tooting Beck as well. My goodness.
What's a goat rodeo, Steve?
I've never heard of
a goat rodeo. Apparently, is it's a rodeo event for children when they get to rustle up a goat instead of a young steer because it would just be too difficult, I guess.
Okay, but something like the pig races they have at the P&E. Yeah.
I didn't know this, but goat rodeo itself is kind of a euphemistic term for a massive balls up, or at least a situation where every little detail has to go correct in order for the whole thing to work.
Oh, sort of a snafu type situation.
Yeah, pretty much.
Maybe it's a military term he's using as well then in that sense.
Yeah.
This is another goat rodeo. Okay, so yeah, let's get on the road. They get moving. They get up. They break down again.
Yeah.
So we kind of cut to the break where they're breaking down. They're getting out of the vehicle and Glenn kind of frowns and he smells this horrible stench coming wafting up the road.
Yeah. It looks like a farm or something, a lot of tractors, but it's completely ridden with zombies. There are like hundreds of them across the road and across the fields in front of them, effectively blocking their path.
In Chilliwack, where I come from, we'd like to call that the smell of money, but I don't imagine it's just manure that they're smelling at this particular point. No, there are thousands of these guys, thousands. And they're far enough away that they can't see our heroes standing on a ridge. But Abraham's adamant they're going forward. That's it, they're going forward.
But everyone else is immediately sure they're not.
And here Rosita actually steps up and says, can't go forward. We have to go around. We have to find an alternate route. He tries to say, well, we could just drive right through them. And they point out, yeah, we hit them. They slow us down. He tries to say, well, we'll just go around them. Well, there's only one straight road, Maggie points out. That's where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
So he just keeps on resisting every moment. So instead of answering their complaints, he grabs Eugene by the arm and starts to march him back to the truck.
Starts to hold him back. Yeah, just before we talk about what happens after this, I don't know, did you notice that when everyone else is deciding what they should or shouldn't do, Abraham's kind of muttering to himself. And he says three short phrases. He says, I will not lie down. I will not abase. I will not give up the ship. The way he was reading those lines, it made me feel like he was quoting something, but I couldn't find any reference to it.
Some sort of a mantra that he has for himself in that moment.
It sounded kind of biblical, but he said, I will not give up the ship. Mm-hmm.
Which, there's got to be a connection there. Okay, well, how about you say what happens, and I'm going to do a quick search.
Yeah, so he grabs Eugene, and he starts taking him back to the fire truck, intent on forcing everyone to go right through. And this isn't really going down well with other people. Glenn grabs him, Rosita and Tara grab him. They're all telling him he's nuts, he has to stop, that they're going to get them killed.
He knocks Glenn down. down. He knocks Rosita down.
That kind of thing. He's swinging the gun around. Abraham's kind of losing it here. He's not showing his best leadership qualities. And then Eugene, who just hates any form of conflict, just starts to kind of wet his pants and freak out. And he decides that now is the moment to drop the big bombshell. So just underneath all the screaming and shouting, you can hear Eugene bleating, "I'm not a scientist."
He's actually, his words are, "I lied. I'm not a scientist. I don't know how to stop it." And okay, well there, and sorry. Because sorry makes everything better. As far as the not giving up the ship is concerned, the only thing I can come up with is something spoken by Captain James Lawrence on the U.S. frigate Chesapeake during the War of 1812. He said, "Don't give up the ship," which was an order to the men, that he was wounded and dying. And he's basically like, he says, "Tell the men to fire faster. Don't give up the ship." So the thing is, though, Abraham's army, right? He's a sergeant in the army, from what we can tell. He's not Navy. I don't think. If he was based outside of Houston, he's probably Army. It could be that he's making a connection with...
Well, it was in 1812, so I presume he was making overtures.
Oh, my God.
I don't even know if it was the 1812.
I'm in the wrong podcast.
Was it the 1812 overture? I'm hoping it was.
Well, the 1812 overture was about the Napoleonic Wars. It was about the invasion of Russia by France.
Yeah, that's good enough for me.
There are cannons involved. There's the Marseillaise. There's the Russian national anthem. It has nothing, may I repeat, to do with the USS Chesapeake. But that's okay. You can make that blind connection. I don't mind. You should take more history classes, man. I tell you, all the sociology is ruining your brain. You want to be a polymath, not a specialist. Then you can live in the new world.
In H.G. Wells' new world. Yeah, so so Eugene's he's spilling the beans.
Before he gets to that quite to that point, one of the reasons he spills the beans is because Abraham shoves Rosita to the ground. He shoves Glenn to the ground. He's mad. He's a mad bull at this point. Mm. And the gun that he's holding is waving around wildly, pointing right in Eugene's face several times. In fact, it was done in such a way with the shot that it almost looked as though I was kind of half expecting the gun to go off.
Yeah.
At that point. And that's when Eugene's like, you know, screw this shit, because I've been trying to stay alive by lying. Now the lie is going to get us all killed.
Mm-hmm.
Maggie looks horrified. She looks over at him with this like kind of just disgusted look on her face. And Rosita, I believe, says to him, like, "People have died to keep you alive."
Yeah, Eugene lists all the people.
He's obviously remembered all the names, which is to his favor.
And then he turns and says, "And Bob."
And we could argue that Bob's death has very little to do with Eugene and his lies, because they were all headed to Terminus regardless of Eugene.
So his speech is very confessorial. He's telling everyone what he's done and how bad he feels that he's lied. But then he takes a change of tone.
Yes.
He moves from apologizing to kind of making the case for keeping him around, because he understands that he's not exactly going to be popular now. So he starts saying, "But I'm smart." And then he makes this little joke. He says that he lied about what T. Brooks Ellis says about his mullet, but he says that he'd read a few things about T. Brooks Ellis and said that he wouldn't blink twice at a Tennessee top hat.
Mm-hmm.
And this doesn't seem to go down too well with Abraham.
Abraham kind of gives him the eye, and then he turns to Abraham and he says, "But I am smarter than you." Abraham does not take kindly to that.
Nope. So Abraham nails him three times, pretty solid. Well, he stands up, hits him twice with his left. People are trying to restrain him. Eugene's backed up against the fire truck, and then he just decks him right in the
face.
Hits
him a third time, and then he's out on his feet.
Guy goes down with a crunch.
Face first onto the pavement.
He's looking pretty messed up.
Yeah, and as they roll him over, you see like a wound on his forehead and blood oozing out.
Yeah, his nose is all busted up. His eyes are kind of rolled back. He's gurgling blood. It's looking pretty grim for Eugene.
He doesn't look much different from the guys in the grocery store, actually, from the flashback.
Almost identical, yeah. There seemed to be a bit of an echo there. We start the show with that scene, and then we end it with the same thing. And as you were mentioning before, the symbolism of the old hand there.
Now, we've got Abraham. He walks away after he's been talked out of killing Eugene in the moment. And he falls to his knees and looks skyward, which then we cut from that to the final flashback, which is where he finds his family, falls to his knees, and puts the gun in his mouth. But we go a bit beyond that. We hear, "Help me, help me.
Help me." And who's that running across the abandoned parking lot of a Texas barbecue?
I wouldn't call it running. What would you call Eugene's movement there? His arms are flaying about. Like, you know what? He looks like a velociraptor with useless arms who can't actually, like, he's injured. One of the walkers that's chasing him down actually has something attached to its leg and is dragging it, and it's still outrunning him.
He was so, so pathetic looking that you got the feeling the whole thing was staged.
Yeah, well, he's like running away from these things for a while, perhaps for a year at this point.
Just those three things.
Yeah, those three. They've been chasing him forever. And he sees his salvation in this man with a gun. Yeah. Now, interestingly, he obviously sees Abraham on his knees with the gun in his mouth. He knows what he's about to do. He pleads with him for help. Abraham just comes over and very businesslike, sloosh, 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 you know, stabs him all in the head.
Then goes back to resume killing himself.
And you can see this calculation, this moment of calculation in Eugene's eyes. And this here is, to me, the justification for everything that follows.
Mm-hmm.
He actually saves Abraham's life.
Yeah.
Without Abraham realizing it. He says, I'm on a very important mission.
Mm.
And this here is it.
And I think you get the feeling that he is extremely intelligent, because Abraham tears off his dog tags, doesn't he?
He's already done that. Yeah, he saw the wife and kids. He kneels. He tears off his dog tag, throws it on the wife's body.
Right.
And then puts the gun in his mouth.
Now, that's troublesome for me, because I had this theory that Eugene very quickly sussed that this was an army guy.
I think he did anyway. You think of how Abraham's dressed. We also don't know. I mean, at the speed that Eugene was running, he very well might have seen the dog tags coming off.
Yeah.
And he, as you say, he susses out the situation. He looks at it. He says, okay, this is how this guy's going to react. He sees Abraham as a big, tough, testosterone-driven bull, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he uses very specific language. He says, I have a very important mission. You can see Abraham's ears prick up when he hears that word, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, if there's a purpose to living that can exist for Abraham after he's lost his family, it seems like it's going to come in the form of a mission.
And here, Eugene sees this, again, as a win-win situation. Mm-hmm. Now, when he's at the fire truck and he's just made his admissions, again, he uses that term, win-win. He says that, you know, sure, by the time we got to DC, I'd have to admit to the lie, but then you'd all be in a safer place. So it's actually a win-win for everyone, is how he looks at it, despite all the deaths that have occurred, of course. So this is how they get tied together.
Right.
Now, he's just tried to kill him. I think that if Eugene survives, they're not going to be friends, but I think that they'll be able to manage to be in the same room together.
Right.
And I think this is partly because when Abraham calms down, he's going to remember, yeah, the only reason I'm still alive is because Eugene did give me a mission.
Yeah.
Did now give me something to do.
That's true. But nonetheless, that mission is now gone. What does Abraham really have to hang on to now?
The secondary part of that mission, that Washington, D.C. might be the best prepared area in the country for survival, could still act as a mission. But now he also has a group of people that he respects and that respect him.
Yeah, he's the shepherd. His job now is not necessarily to save humanity, but at least to save the people around him.
I think this will partly break him, though, too. I think that this is in the sense that, as far as being the dominant alpha male is concerned, I think he's going to probably in future defer to Rick, especially in situations of making big choices that might get people hurt.
Right, yeah. I imagine he might be quite ashamed of himself. Do you think they're just going to head straight back to the church?
Yeah, actually, I do. I think they're probably going to head back to gather up the group or get together with the rest of the group again. I'm a little bit fearful for the direction the show might be going, because it's had such a strong start to the season.
Right.
But if you start going backwards and treading water, then you're turning into season two and Herschel's Farm all over again. And
we don't want that. I was thinking exactly the same thing. You've got a few dead ends now, and I'm starting to wonder about the overall direction of this season. Washington at the beginning of this season seemed to be what was going to be driving most of the action forward, but already that's questionable. And the only thing we kind of have to look forward in the near future is some kind of attack of this hospital or a resolution of Beth's storyline.
Which I suspect will be before the end of the... Well, it'll probably be the mid-season finale, yes.
You would imagine, which means we're going to need a kind of a reboot. The only thing that I can see working is that if they learn something during their attack of the hospital that gives them some sort of impetus, some sort of direction. But otherwise, we don't really have anything driving the group on.
Well, you do have Officer Lerner, who seems really certain they're going to be rescued at some point. She might have information we're not privy to at this moment.
It's possible, although the look on her face when Beth confronted her with that, it seemed to belie a little bit of doubt.
Yeah, there was a kind of an unsubstantiated faith that she was having undermined by Beth in that moment. That's true. That did look kind of that way. Oh, it's going to be interesting to see where it goes. I really think, like, it. So I'm hoping that, especially if Eugene survives, that he'll try to convince them that this is best for them to go north. I don't know how much, he's not going to have any sway, of course.
Eugene's going to survive.
He has to.
You never leave a character. If a character's left ambiguously near death at the end of an episode, they always survive.
Yeah, well, I agree. And the thing is, he's going to have a much more interesting relationship with the group now.
Yeah, definitely. They're going to have to find a new use for him. But he's got an awful lot of potential, though.
Well, he's still got the knowledge, right? He is knowledgeable, unless he's been brain damaged.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, can you imagine, though, not only is he useless, but he's also unable to, you know, move or speak for himself now. That would be a really interesting character in the zombie apocalypse. What would be the motivation for keeping him alive at all.
Oh,
right?
Man, yeah. Imagine him carrying Tyrese, Eugene, and Beth around under those circumstances.
Well, I guess you could always kind of snug Judith onto his wheelchair with him.
Yeah.
And push them both along. You do have kind of a similar motif that happened in the first season with the Vatos, which I mentioned last week in the podcast. So, you know, people looking after those that can't look after themselves. And the thing is, too, Rick's people, as much as they've had to make hard choices and they've killed a lot of people, they're still good. You know, I mean, that's the whole kind of motivating factor, that this idea of good and kind of an optimism for the future. I suspect that if Eugene's alive in any way, shape, or form, they're just going to say, yeah, well, we're going to keep you alive still because you're part of us now. You're one of us.
Yeah, it's going to happen. Mercy is something that the group's always shown, particularly towards characters that we already know. I can't think of anyone who's just been betrayed or left to die who we've already got to know.
There was some question over how they were going to treat Andrea.
Right.
There was some question over how they were going to treat Merle.
Yeah.
There, you know, because obviously Merle wanted Michonne dead. Michonne was treated with a lot of suspicion for a long time before she became accepted as part of the group.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they've never actually turned somebody out to sure death. I mean, he took Carol to that subdivision, but he also knew Carol was going to look after herself.
Maggie's still conspicuous by her lack of any consideration at all for her sister.
Yeah, it was crazy. Again, she talks, in fact, about the people she's missing back at the church.
That's the thing.
She mentions several, but she mentions finding out what happened to Daryl and Carol, but she doesn't mention what happened to her sister.
Yeah, that's a huge issue. She's worried about the group. And when they're in the bus going forward, she says, well, maybe they're behind us. Maybe they're driving along. You know, yeah,
Daryl and Carol may have come back, and they may be on their way here right now.
Not a word about Beth. It seems to just have been totally overlooked.
Maggie's motivations this season are highly suspect. I don't even see her as much of a character so far this season. She's been almost subsumed into Glenn.
That's the thing. So let's just talk about that just briefly. Running in the tradition of disposing of the more expendable characters, it seems to be the more expendable ones die, certainly during the first half of any season. But who is the most expendable now? Because I think Maggie's starting to make a good case, because her death would actually be a little bit significant for Glenn and other people. She's been around for a while, so you can see how her death might actually give characters additional motivation. Mm-hmm. But I think we could kind of lose Rosita without it really affecting anything.
Or Tara, for that matter.
Probably Tara, too. Yeah, either of those two characters seems like that they could be killed just to add a little bit of spice to a set piece, perhaps assaulting a hospital or doing something along those lines.
But Maggie's been a major character for 2 and a bit years now. So, I mean, she'd be... Or three and a bit years. So she would be a heavy-duty death. And that would be... She's not going to die until she's pregnant, though, dude.
I know you were saying, yeah.
This is nothing to do with the comics. But I truly feel that if they're going to off either Glenn or Maggie, it's going to be after she gets pregnant. Because they could have offed either of them after they got back together and it was all happy-happy.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been very traumatic for us as an audience, but they didn't. So now they have to wait till something ups the ante, and it's going to be a pregnancy, I think.
Have they spoken about trying to get pregnant in the show? Because I know that it is something that goes on in the comic at one point.
No, it was at the prison. She told him that she got her period, and he was relieved.
Right.
But they were actually talking about having a kid at that point, because they were starting to feel complacent or comfortable, at least.
Maybe they think their best chance of getting fertility treatment would also be in DC.
That's true.
There you go.
There's some great fertility doctors there. You've talked about who Abraham is biblically. There's the kneeling pose he has both at the end of the present showtime and in the flashback sequence, which is a position of supplication, very much like Father Gabriel in episode 2 when they were in the basement. So you get this kind of supplication, very religious, the idea of kneeling and praying. But you also have the bloody hand, which is a motif carried right through the show. Now, I made a huge mistake on this because for some reason I thought it was his bloody red hand. His right hand, but it was his left, wasn't it? I feel horrible about that because I did all this research on right hands. But I'm sticking to it. It's just reversed, that's all. The red hand, of course, is an idiomatic statement in English, the idea of being caught red-handed, right? It shows guilt. You've got Lady Macbeth with the out-out damn spot trying to wash the blood off her hands. You've got this sense of it showing culpability. But there's also the sense of red hands kind of showing honest work, that you've worked hard, you've worked in the cold, you've worked with your hands, you've done something real in the world. There's also the sense of being at the hand of somebody, like you are somebody's hand. The right hand obviously has more power. The idea of Jesus sitting on the right hand of God. But on the left hand of God is, you know, one of the angels, I believe Gabriel. There's this sense of, I'm probably completely wrong on that, we'll get corrected, but that's okay. Comments are welcome. Please correct me. But it's still an important place. It's the sinister as opposed to the dexter. So it has a darkness associated with it on the left.
It- Yeah, it does. What I thought the main significance of the red hand was really is just kind of a symbol of his rage. He continually opens up those scars, like he has a deep emotional pain, which is revealed today in the loss of his wife and children. But we also get the idea that he's someone who can't control his anger. We know that he's ex-military. Maybe this is always a part of his personality, or maybe they're hinting at something subtle like PTSD and the sort of long-term behavioral problems that can cause, the adjustment. You know, they might even use this as ways to make the point that Abraham is kind of at home in this world, because I think at some point towards the end of the show, he starts talking about killing and how killing is all that's left.
Yeah, he actually talks to Glenn about that.
Yeah.
And basically says that the only people left alive are the strong. And,
yeah.
And sometimes we're going to have to kill. That's just what we're going to have to do. I do notice a consistency, though. Whenever we see Abraham killing a person or attacking a person as opposed to a walker, he gets this haunted, almost lost look of wonderment in his eyes, like, what did I just do?
Mm-hmm.
How was I capable of that thing that just happened? And there's a disconnect for him between his actions and his ability to process those actions.
Right.
So I don't know if it's PTSD, almost a dissociative state.
Right.
I can't get that word out very well. It's a tough one.
So he's certainly a conflicted person, someone who has a significant role to play, someone who signifies a lot of rage and guilt, but also, you know, in the traditional, in the biblical sense, a figure of sacrifice, someone who's called upon to fulfill a certain duty and is willing to do it, yet the mission can change at the last minute.
Okay, so yeah, there was a lot of heavy symbolism in this episode. It reminded me a little bit of, I believe it was episode 401, when Rick meets that Irish woman and gets taken out into the woods.
Right.
And she's bringing him to meet her husband who needs help. Well, he's, you know, an immobile zombie or walker, a non-walker. He's a liar, would that be what he is? And she's trying to find food for her husband.
Mm.
But there are several scenes as she is taking him through the woods where we focus in on a spider and a web, or where we do these other things. Same thing happened in the last episode of last season, episode 416, where Rick is showing Carl how a trap works, how you funnel everybody, you know, all the squirrels down into this lane so then they get into the noose, which is exactly a cognate for what's happening to them on their way to Terminus. So the show is not afraid to use symbolism. The Red Hand, I think, was a very nice piece of it, to be perfectly honest. I think it was a bit more subtle than some of the stuff they've done in the past. It was less, shall I say, heavy-handed. Sorry.
Yeah. You can get away with that.
Okay, thanks. But I really enjoyed the episode. I thought, as you said, it was an improvement on last week's. Next week's looks pretty exciting. They had a brief commercial near the end of the episode. If you watched Talking Dead, you saw a little bit more. But let's just say we're going to be getting some Daryl and Carol next week.
We're heading back to the hospital.
I'm expecting full-on badass kickassery, tremendous crossbow moments, and other things. All right, well, this was a lot of fun, Dan, as always.
Yeah, a lot of fun, Steve.
And I'm looking forward to talking to you again next week.
See you later, guys.
And just a reminder, if you want to check out my written reviews, go to reviewsbysteve.wordpress.com. Thank you.
Bye.